Dr. G. Ernest Wright.
Well, it's an honor to be invited to share my interests. I hope you'll feel like applauding when I'm finished. You never know about these things. We have a connection between the Old Testament department at Harvard and this school in Carl Gresser, who used to formerly taught here, is now working for his doctorate in our school. In fact, we have four Missouri Lutheran doctoral candidates in our department of Old Testament. And our first doctorate under the new regime, the cross-right regime at Harvard in Old Testament, our first doctorate was a Missouri Lutheran boy, Paul Lapp, who is the director of the American School of Oriental Research in Jerusalem, Jordan, the first archaeological scholar to man that school since the great days in the 20s and the 30s of Albright and Glick. Carl Gresser, of course, is the spark plug, I understand, who more than any other is responsible for securing the interest of the proper authorities in the Missouri Lutheran Church to sponsor an excavation, which it is hoped will begin this summer if somebody doesn't put a bullet in the body of King Hussein. And that means that archaeology in the Near East is always a touch-and-go proposition. Interest in biblical archaeology is far higher today, I suppose, than ever before in the history of the discipline. Since the founding of the State of Israel, when every other Israeli is an avid archaeologist, almost a substitute for religion in Israel, it's just very difficult even for a scholar to keep up with all that's going on. It's a very rapidly moving field, the most rapidly moving field in the area of ancient history. A German journalist named Werner Keller cashed in on this interest a few years ago. He published a book called The Bible as History, A Confirmation of the Book of Books, which is translated and published in this country in 1956. A publisher friend of mine told me recently, when I asked him about this, he found out that that book has sold 226,000 copies in this country up until from between 56 and last December, 1962. He says in his letter, "Do you have any ideas for a new and better kind of Keller book? If you do, I'll be on the next plane for Harvard and make any down payment you want to ask." Actually, I did follow Werner Keller with a book called Biblical Archaeology, which was a more judicious attempt at the subject in 1957, but obviously it didn't do so well. Keller's theme is that archaeology has proved the truth of biblical history. The title of the book in German is much better. The Bible is still right. Now, there are people both here and abroad who honestly think and frequently assert that Palestinian and biblical archaeology was conceived and reared by conservative Christians who wish to find support for their faith in the accuracy of the Bible. But as a matter of fact, this is simply not the case at all. In another place, I have tried to briefly outline the history of this question, how in the last century, up until the time of the First World War, archaeology was rarely used in the great fundamentalist modernist debate. It was a danger, really, because there are such things as Bishop Usher's chronology, 4004 B.C. for the creation, and the Babylonian flood story, and all these things were getting in the way of convenient use. So that the actual introduction of the theme, archaeology confirms biblical history, I believe, is to be found in the works of my own teacher, William Foxwell Albright at Johns Hopkins University, who since the 1920s has towered over the field of biblical archaeology as the greatest giant the field has produced. and more than any other single person has influenced young scholars, Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish, to take the subject seriously as a primary tool of historical research. And at the same time, he has been a most important encouragement to young conservative scholars. Through his writings, they've come to realize that if they but master the tools of research, there's indeed a positive contribution that they can make to biblical research, for radical views which they can cannot accept do not necessarily find support in recent research. Of course, Albright has been often misunderstood at this point. Oswald T. Alice, if you know his works, likes to point out that, after all, Albright is an old liberal at heart, which indeed, from Mr. Alice's standards, is probably true. Further, it can be said that fundamentalist or very conservative money is a very minor element in archaeology. Lots of people are interested in archaeology. Few contribute to the cost of getting the stuff out of the ground. We have spent now nearly $100,000, not counting the travel expenses of most of the staff, on Shechem, and more to come. And it's a major operation raising that money, and none of it comes, I'm sorry to say, from the real people who are really interested, dynamically interested in biblical research. The Drew McCormick expedition. McCormick gets credit for being one of the sponsors, not because McCormick was so excited about archaeology back in the days when the thing was set up. They went into it simply because the president had a surplus in a particular year, and he wanted to keep G. Ernest Wright happy, and that's the extent of their interest. Similarly, in Harvard, each one of us has our own research interests, and that's that. There's no real profound depth. But I have always had two interests in my life. One has been this archaeological historical interest, and the other is theology. And I've, for years now, been working, for the last 25 years of my academic career, trying to keep myself together. So here's another speech on that same line. How do I hold myself together? What is the purpose of archaeology in the context of the Christian church? How can one really deal with this question? The real purpose of biblical archaeology, of course, is simply to understand a religious literature that is most unusual, with nothing like it in the world's religious history. Here is a religious literature that rests its case for the revelation of God on a people's historical tradition as interpreted theologically. Here is presented not a God of philosophy, who is to be comprehended slowly in the general principles expounded by reasoned logic, but instead a God of history, who is to be known primarily in the testimony to his activity, which biblical people saw as the explanation for their own history. The knowledge of the biblical God is therefore historical knowledge that is best expressed in the dialogue of events, in the attempt to understand the meaning of the human struggle, in the otherwise meaningless chaos of human triumph and defeat. This fact led Israel to preserve, to collect, and ultimately to write down her historical traditions. And she was the first people in world history so to do. Israel's knowledge of God led her to an interest in history, because this God had chosen the forms of history as the way in which he revealed himself as their God. And I might say that the whole evolution of the science, might call, in quotation marks, of history, is a Western phenomenon, not Eastern. It's a Western phenomenon produced in a culture heavily influenced by this biblical background. And I don't believe that that's accidental. To comprehend and to appropriate this religion requires that we become deeply involved historically, both in Israel's history amidst the imperialistic struggles of the first great age of human history, of human civilization on earth, and as well with our own history. There's no beyond to which we can go for primary knowledge. There's no arena of logic which contains or adequately states the case. No mystical exercise which by itself alone provides the key to understanding. The Bible as historical testimony does not exhaust or even penetrate the mystery of ultimate power and meaning. But it does claim to reveal God as he would be known as our God. As such, to use a figure of Calvin, I'm sorry I don't have one of Luther at hand, the Bible serves as a pair of spectacles, not to see all knowledge, but to see meaning, value, purpose by faith in what otherwise would be meaninglessness, valueless confusion. Now, the application of the tools of the historian to the Bible has involved a certain rationalistic risk that the boundary set for faith would be transgressed. But the church has survived this rationalism, and the ability of Christianity to adjust its biblical interpretation to new situations in history and science, that I submit is an amazing story. Her faith has been enriched, not destroyed thereby, by all this historical research. I would say that it's touch and go as to whether Islam, which has a truly fundamentalist view of scriptural inspiration as regards the Quran, whether Islam can ever really so adapt itself to the modern world. Very peculiar situation there. Biblical archaeology is simply the research arm of the historian who wishes to fit our knowledge of biblical literature squarely within the context of its time, its geography, its climate, its historical and cultural setting, so that the Bible becomes an integral, not a separate, part of the history of man. And this attempt has borne remarkable fruit in our time. Biblical teaching has been revolutionized. The Old Testament, particularly, has become a fresh and exciting literature. Even theology, as I shall mention in a few moments, is being revolutionized. It's at this crucial point of understanding what it is that makes Israel Israel amidst the imperialistic struggles of the ancient nations that has so enriched our understanding and that has given archaeology its place of encounter with reality. Theology and history are inseparable. Both require of the scholar an act of self-transcendence whereby he can reconstruct and participate in both the biblical events and their interpretation, or in more traditional language, to comprehend both the event and the word which expounds that event. But the great numbers of people interested in archaeology in our time have not surprised me as much as the gradual discovery of those in academic circles who are not interested in the discipline. I want to talk about them now for the rest of the morning. The typical philosopher and theologian, as I have discovered him, is simply not interested in the discipline at all. He's inclined to regard, this I know from personal experience, this is autobiography, so to speak, he's inclined to consider his archaeological colleague as somehow intellectually second rate, or if he isn't, he's concerned with something that is certainly peculiar and certainly peripheral to anything that's important. But what really lies behind this attitude, however, is the plain fact that these academic colleagues in philosophy and theology actually possess small interest in history, perhaps because their disciplines have not required them to be. As a result, they find themselves today with strange bedfellows, ranged alongside, for example, the social scientists, the psychologists, the sociologists, particularly the classical discipline of anthropology, which none of which have any interest in history at all, never have had. During the past 150 years, the discipline of history, as we know it, has come into being. It has had radical results for the human mind, because the knowledge of our past and of our present has been so vastly extended. As a result, we modern people in the West have had our attitudes and our outlooks so changed that we will never be the same again. In reaction to 18th century rationalism, with its affirmation that reality is essentially a rational structure, the 19th century saw the emergence of a historicism which saw reality as primarily historical. If you want to know anything important about the human scene, then first of all, you learn something about its history, its background, its development. That is, the historical process in all its variety, in all its flux and change. Instead of the eternal stability of reason and human nature, the concepts of development, of change, of individual differentiation took hold. And as one scholar has put it, this is the greatest spiritual revolution which Western thought has undergone. Today, one section of the humanities is solidly historical because it is felt that one knows little about anything without knowing its history. And on the other hand, there's an ever-growing section that is anti-historical. Depth psychology, for example, believes it can interpret the human being and his life from the deep wells of the unconscious. From this perspective, psychiatrists occasionally make forays into the interpretation of history, with results that are questionable when they're not ludicrous. For example, Freud's Moses and monotheism, or the psychoanalysis of Ezekiel. Sociology and anthropology have possessed very little historical focus until just recent times. Anthropology is now getting a new lease on life through the attempt to pay a little attention to archaeology. I don't need to go into this. But we can also point to certain trends in the culture surrounding us, in modern art, for example, and generally in culture, tendencies which possess definitely an anti-historical bias. In music, literature, and painting, we are witness to a revolt against the tyranny of the past, a struggle for new forms of expression, even a highly sophisticated return to the primitive. Recently, I understand everything is going to folks music, but when my two older sons were in high school and college, up until about two or three years ago anyway, different kind of music was very much in their center of attention. That emphasized the beat. It was the beat, the primitive, the African in us was coming out. And we had one or two of these jam stations in our house, and it was rather curious to me that these kids did nothing but sit around all evening. You couldn't sing the stuff. I mean, they didn't sing. They just could only move their bodies. Now, this is a return to the primitive. The African in us is coming to the surface. It's quite the fashion to get a piece of African art and put it on the mantelpiece and call it modernistic. An insistent theme of most modern literature has been the vision of chaos, the encounter with the absurd, with everything that is not civilized, because our past is felt to be a prison from which we must liberate ourselves. Now, I'm going to say something here, or repeat something here, that really a sane Christian should not be caught dead doing, but on an excavation in Palestine, you're caught without adequate library resources, and mysterious bits of paperback literature appear in camp, and we circulate these around, and this is what we have to read while resting. Last summer on the excavation camp in Shechem in Jordan, a paperback copy of this terrible book of Henry Miller, Tropic of Cancer, appeared. And I read it, this thing, but out of it came the only good quotation of all my paperback reading last summer, and I'd like to share that quotation with you. Henry Miller, when thinking about his year as a teacher of English in a boys' school, exclaims, "There's something obscene in this love of the past which ends in bread lines and dugouts. There's something obscene about this spiritual racket which permits an idiot to sprinkle holy water over big berthas and dreadnoughts and high explosives. Every man with a belly full of classics is an enemy of the human race." Now, that's kind of a radical accusation. The fellow is saying that those of us who spend so much time on history are incapable of responsible action in the present. But I think there's a lot more here than that. It's the fact that these so-called realists of the Miller type, as also the existentialists, simply can't stomach history. It's mostly wrong. It's a series of human terrors and horrors. We live in the world, new world. What can the past teach us? We've got to be new. Everything has got to be new. All gimmicks for being new, new way of teaching, new curriculum in the academic world. Schools trying to get money out of foundations have got to find out a gimmick somehow to anything new and different you can get money for. Just to do the old thing, the same old thing, it has to be done over and over again, like washing your face. You can't get any money for that. Accompanying the radical developing academic interest in history during the last century and the first part of this, philosophy forged ahead of theology, because it presumed to provide the meaning of history. When I was in theological seminary 35 years ago, it was a time when, in college, in theological seminary, it was a time when you couldn't tell the difference between theology and philosophy amongst many circles in this country. And the best brains were going into philosophy. German idealism at that time was still dominating the scene in many quarters, and it furnished the defense and the reason for the concentration on history. But today, one of the most interesting things is the decline of philosophy and the attempt by reason to provide a coherent and structured view of reality has virtually been abandoned by most major philosophical departments in the country. When I was in college, the philosophy department was one of the central departments in the campus. Today, in school after school across the country, philosophy has just become an appendage of the Department of Religion. It's a shocking thing to philosophers. The classical philosophy is almost dead. People have given up the attempt by the head, the reason, to make sense out of the whole complexity of human experience. Instead, very different ventures are being undertaken under the guise of analytic philosophy, varieties of existentialism, none of them having any particular interest in history. Charles Beard has written, "Since the history of any period embraces all the actualities involved, since both documentation and research are only partial, it follows that the total actuality is not factually knowable to a historian. That is, it's impossible to know everything about a particular period. It's easier to write the history, say, of the 8th century B.C. than it would be of this moment, because you don't know so much about the 8th century B.C., and you can get together all the information that you know under the covers of one head, almost, or at least in the Near East. Carl Gresser is having to do that right now. Any overarching hypothesis or conception, says Beard, employed to give a particular era coherence and structure, that's an interpretation of some kind. It is something transcendent to the facts, whether you call that transcendence reason or God. In other words, the multiplicity of history is so great that its meaning is certainly not apparent in itself. If there's any meaning in human history, then it's a meaning that comes from without, from that which transcends history. Now, surely, this is the primary arena where theology today should be, it must be, at work. The flux of history and its inexhaustible variation has brought with it a relativism with regard to the value that has deeply affected the whole human effort as civilization. Skeptical relativism as a facet of historical method has been turned into an understanding of reality. Here too, this is certainly an arena where theology must be at work. In the context of relativism and meaninglessness, which accentuate the whole drive of modern life toward the non-historical, well, the type of revelation which the church believes the Bible to provide requires of the Christian scholar that he must be vitally concerned with history for religious reasons. It is in history that God has made himself known as our God. Well, if all this is true, it to me is very peculiar that in such a tradition as ours, one should be able to say, and I say this apodictically out of my own experience, that you can almost predict the degree of interest in archaeology and history by the degree of interest a person has in theology. The more interested you are in theology, the less interested you are in archaeology and history. Now, I don't mean that everybody ought to become archaeologists or historians. God forbid. Don't relish too much competition. It's better to keep the, field manageable. I am simply referring to an interest in the basic importance of history as furnishing the primary data which must be the focus of concern for both historian and theologian. But the classical mode of Christian theology has led the discipline in different channels. In medieval days and in post-Reformation orthodoxy, the mainstream of theology proceeded along the Greek pattern in which the vocabulary is composed of abstract universals, the meaning and coherence of which is to be elaborated primarily by logic. Now, all of this derives from an era when the universe was conceived as primarily a rational structure. What is essentially important in such a universe is the unchanging structure of this world, a structure which possesses the power to arrange every particular within the whole. One central interest is the search for universals, which are always valid, and which must be discussed by means of noun plus copula plus another noun or adjective. That is, you say, revelation, whatever that is in general, is the word, the copula, to be, and then such and such, a noun or a series of adjectives. Now contrast the biblical mentality, which cannot or does not believe it can express reality in this way. But instead, the biblical is interested in the, or is concerned with the changing, the personal, the events, the intensely personal view of history. And significance in such a world as the biblical world, with its view of reality, can only be expressed, or primarily be expressed, by means of a subject conjugating a verb. Reality, in other words, is not something fixed, eternally unchangeable, immovable. It is only to be expressed by means of a subject conjugating a verb. That is the way an event is interpreted and expounded. Now, man in the other view, however, in the classic view, participates in the unchanging structure by reason, and he finds it possible to elaborate systems of thought in which every particular can be arranged by a variety of givens, axioms, deductions. Now, in this worldview, a systematic theology as the rational content of faith is possible. Logic is the primary clue to reality, and a correct system can be seen as truth, as the adequate restatement of revelation. A major reason why theological battles were once so terribly fierce was because our fathers believed it really possible to state in rational terms what revelation is, with slight variations of phrasing, so slight that we today are inclined to think them as of no importance. Well, these could be all important. The first theological seminary founded in this country was at Andover, Massachusetts in 1808 by those Puritans who believed warmly in the old Puritan theology and who believed that Harvard was hopelessly liberal and was openly and consciously persisting in that evil, which it was. So, in order to protect the school, the founders of Andover Theological Seminary devised a creed to which all professors must subscribe, not just once, but every 5 years. And that creed was considered final. It was part of the constitution of the school, so that institution and its creed would stand forever or fall together. And they did. Very interesting story, the history of Andover Seminary and its creed, and I'm sorry I can't go into it. Now, such a view that this creed could be eternally unchangeable and valid for all times and places, such a view was only possible in a particular type of world to which rationality of structure was basic. Of course, the liberals in Boston and Cambridge believed that they were being more biblical, and they would cite the Bible against their opponents, but their worldview was essentially the same. Contrast a brief statement of faith adopted by the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in the U.S., the Southern Church, in May 1962. Where there's a lot, this is a common view abroad in the church, much more humble. The conditions of history and the limitations of the human mind and language are such that no statement of Christian doctrine can be either final or complete. Nevertheless, this affirmation is submitted in the hope that it will be used for the glory of God and the edification of the church. Today, the type of world in which such the classic mode of theology was possible, that world has disappeared. To be sure, science finds its regularities and its laws based on normal expectancy. But in the world of human affairs, logic is no longer king. The classic philosophy is gone, and systematic theology is in trouble because it cannot find its system. Now, this is a fact, a sheer fact. A generation ago, when I was in college, you could have predicted the structure of the typical course in theology given in any school across the country. The content could differ a lot, but the general structure you could have predicted. Now you can't predict what any theology course is going to be in any school, unless you know the person doing it, and not even then. And I would say this goes for conservative as well as for the more liberal schools. This has happened in my generation. And we've all been witness to what's happened in the Second Vatican Council over in Rome, where the whole second schema was withdrawn before it was voted down. Why? Simply because of the influence of the new biblical research and the new movements, which meant that two-thirds of the Ecumenical Catholic Council in Rome, two-thirds of the people there had decided that the old business of scripture and tradition, given in the old way as Cardinal Octaviani had done it, simply won't fit the realities of the modern day. Karl Barth's Church Dogmatics is a theology of the Word of God, but it has been criticized as still dominated by the 17th and 18th century mode, wherein the Bible as the revelation of the Word permits the elaboration of a complete system of thought which involves many volumes. It goes on and on, because nothing can be excluded. Every possible rival to it must be critically considered. My colleague Richard Niebuhr has put the matter this way. In Barth's theology of the Word, Christian faith, as participation in the Word of God, does not issue preeminently in the love of God, as it did for St. Augustine, nor in trust in God, as it did for Luther and Calvin, nor in the glorification of God, as it did for Jonathan Edwards. The effect of this procedure is to make Christianity into a faith that is basically a body of knowledge. Thus, at one and the same time, Barthianism endeavors to lift Christianity above human history by making it discontinuous with history, and is constantly fighting rear guard battles and skirmishes with all the human religious assertions about God, as in philosophy and liberal theology, because it has clothed itself in the same human language that philosophy and religion employ, and it looks exactly like them. Contemporary biblical research, however, and the present world in which we live, mean that this type of rationality considered as the proper depiction of revelation is becoming increasingly rare if it is not the last of its kind. Because of the very nature of the Christian religion as derived from its biblical heritage, as I've already indicated, I think that Christian scholars today must be vitally concerned with history. But what is today understood as the basic content of the Bible cannot be properly stated, as I've already implied, by the mode of classical theology with its Greek setting. A century and one half of historical research has so altered our perspectives that current theology, that is, the attempt to state the biblical case meaningfully in our time, finds itself floundering and uncertain of what it is doing. The first thing to be said about man today is not that he possesses certain faculties of reason and nature that are unchanging in all situations, so that it can be said that human nature never changes. I would submit instead that what is to be said is that man is man only in the whole complex of his relationships and commitments, that man is first and foremost a historical and time-full being, that human nature does indeed change. It has repeatedly changed. Though, of course, the change is always within a biological structure that defines Homo sapiens. And the first thing to be said about the God of the Bible concerns his historical actions, which have created a new people and which have placed the acknowledgement of sovereignty and vocation under God as the meaning and the content of their life. There is no other realm of knowledge available to us whereby this God is to be known except the historical. So the first thing to be said about God is his historicity, the time-full character of the knowledge we have of him. And the first thing to be said about the Bible as a testimony to this new reality in the world and the fountain of the religious movements that have emerged from it is not that its revelation can be characterized as a Torah, instruction in law, or a rational reality of primary importance solely to the mind, or an otherworldly mythology encased in an outmoded geography of the universe. Instead, its historical character, its revelatory events, strike deep within the human soul at the springs of human action and bring about a restructuring of the self within a new historical community. The current movement of biblical theology, in Germany especially, has been emphasizing very much this event character of the Bible. So that in modern theological parlance, words like kerygma or kerygma, a German word for proclamation as distinct from ethical teaching, and Heilsgeschichte, a German term for the biblical story of God's saving activity, these are now as familiar in theological circles as salvation and redemption and eschatology. But strange things happen in the work of the New Testament scholar Rudolf Bultmann, for example, and his Old Testament counterpart, Gerhard von Rott. The theological confession of God's activity in these men is so wrenched apart from history as to leave it almost completely a cultic myth, divorced radically from the concrete reality, so that the significance of the confession is somehow dissociated from history. Of course, the confession claims to be expounding the significance of historical events. Any interest in the facts, such as I have always had as an archaeologist, that's dismissed as a foolish historicism, a mere factuality in which a person shouldn't be interested without feeling embarrassed about it. Heilsgeschichte in the Old Testament becomes a series of confessions within the cultic life which present an open future, but their fulfillment is so new, so complete, as to render them of no further value except as they hold in themselves some prefiguration of the new existence revealed in the fulfillment. In other words, the history of salvation, Heilsgeschichte, becomes non-historical, and resort has to be made then to some type of existentialism to make it relevant again. Existentialism here attempts to draw the main categories for theology from the central concerns of existence. What are the central concerns of existence? Their life and death, existence, non-existence, and all the anxiety which the threat of non-being holds before us. This is Tillich, this is especially Bultmann. Now, these are ultimate concerns. That's true. Nobody wants to die. You can help it. But these ultimate concerns, life and death, they are non-historical because they are set at the bounds of life, not at the center of life. They're the ultimate boundaries of life. And that's the reason why, I believe, they are kept away from the forefront of religious attention in the Bible. It's not the tree of life which is concerned with life apart from death in the Genesis story, but it's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil that's the center of that interpretive literature, Genesis 3. Just so in the New Testament, life after death is God's prerogative. We can't do anything about it here. That's God's business. Resurrection from the dead is God's miracle, his working. But life in Christ now, that is given us as our concern. The ultimate issues of life and death are in the hands of God. Our issue is vocation in history now. In short, the type of biblical theology that uses history to get rid of history, and thus actually to evade the central issue of both Bible and human history, is, I believe, doing us no service. It's small wonder, then, it seems to me, that systematic theology of the older style having become problematic, numbers of the younger theologians are attracted by the Bultmann and von Rott programs, though they may attempt minor adjustments in the position without significantly altering it. And one can mention certain books, Carl Michelson's The Hinge of History, An Existentialist Approach to the Christian Faith, Schubert Ogden, Christ Without Myth, which is simply gilding the lily of Bultmann, and so on, as samples. You can gather that I'm a rather radical anti-existentialist, but on for theological and the biblical grounds. To me, such efforts are evading the essential issue. I must still affirm the position that history cannot be evaded, that the question of man's existential concern can never be solved apart from the context of society, history, and the struggle of civilization to be civilized. That's what it's all about. The sovereignty of God in the biblical context is encountered precisely in this type of human context. The struggle to understand our past is a crucial question, then, for both historian and theologian. And it's in that frame of reference, then, that I would attempt to defend the archaeological endeavor with all its particularity and all its facticity. Thank you.